Okay, I'm going to call to order this Thursday, February 4th, 2016 meeting of the Senate Committee on Workforce and General Government to order. Welcome everyone to it. We have several items on the agenda, and guess what? We're not dealing with them in order. So we're going to start with the Senate Bill 1532, the minimum wage bill, and then we will go back to Senate Bill 1544, and then we will go to Senate Bill 1508, and then Senate Bill 1534. And then our public hearing on Senate Bill 1587. Okay. So I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1532, which is the minimum wage bill. And we are not going to be voting on this bill today, but I wanted to explain to you the most recent set of amendments. They're the Dash 13s, Lucky 13. And I can't promise that 13 will be the final number, but for now that's where we are. And I want to explain this plan to you all. It was just posted on the legislative information system about an hour ago, and I want to let you know just what it is and what it does. And we are scheduling an additional meeting of this committee for tomorrow at 1 o'clock, colleagues, for the purpose of discussing among ourselves Senate Bill 1532 and its amendments, and perhaps voting it out, depending on how our discussion and debate goes. So just wanted to let you know that. So I don't know if you have before you the Dash 13s, but they're on OLIS. And what we are doing in this, you'll remember that in the previous amendments that we discussed, was it just 2 days ago? Gosh, I can't believe that. We discussed the Dash 1 amendments, and that had a two-region system for the state, the Portland metro area and then the rest of the state. And what we're doing here with the Dash 13s is we are returning to the concept that was in the placeholder bill, the original bill, of having three regions. So we have, Portland metro area. We have and that would be where the wage would be the highest. And then we have, so let's call that region three. And then we have region one, which is the more frontier parts of the state, where economy is not as dynamic, where the cost of living is lower, and we have the then those in the middle. Okay. And do you have the amendments in front of you?
I do.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. And there's a member amendments printed for every member.
Oh, okay. Thanks. Right. So those that are in what here is being called the non-urban counties, which is the more frontier region of the state, include Baker County, Coos County, Crook County, Curry County, Douglas County, Gilliam, Grant, Harney, Jefferson, Klamath, Lake, Malheur, Morrow, Sherman, Umatilla, Union, Wallowa, and Wheeler. You can could tell. Those were not in geographical order. Those were in alphabetical order. Just for all of you, I'm sure you can see this. This is the map, and we'll get this posted up just because it's easier, I think, to see it visually what we're looking at. You may ask why we're making this move from two tiers to three tiers, from two regions to three regions, or from two schedules to three schedules. The reason is that we took a lot of testimony in this committee. We heard a lot of concern from some of the, those frontier parts of the state that they were going to have a particularly hard time accommodating to these increases. Some of them really preferred that their counties be excluded completely, frankly, from the increase in the minimum wage. That is, from my perspective, just not acceptable. There are workers in those counties that need a rise in their wage. Listened to the concerns that we heard, and so we have come up with this third region that brings in the increases at a slower rate and takes us to a different, a lower top rate. Actually, the top rate at the end will be a dollar less than the middle region. So just to back up, and again, this is all laid out in the bill. The metro area by July of 2022, the minimum wage will be $14.75. And then in the middle region, we are retaining the dollar and a quarter difference between that, that region and the top. So that'll be $13.50. And then this new or returning to the original notion of a third region, that will get to $12.50 by July of 22. And will be giving to that region, its first increase will come this summer, July 1, and it'll be a 25-cent increase from 9.25 to 9.50. And Region 2 and Region 3, the middle and the metro, will again, as was before, be at 9.75, so it'll be a 50-cent increase. Again, the goal was to have, a slightly smaller increase for the frontier counties. That, I think, is it in a nutshell. We're still, retaining that methodology that after the 2022 final increase, we return to CPI. There'll be an annual then cost of living increase. And it's going to be based on that middle tier, which used to be what we called the statewide region. And so the CPI will be applied to that middle region, and then the metro region will remain a dollar and a quarter above that, and the new frontier region will be a dollar below that, so that separation will continue each year. The exact amount will be a function of what the CPI is for that year. The question, and I touched on this on Tuesday, the question of how you determine where the rate applies. In most cases, it's going to be straightforward, right? The store you work in is in Region 1. You get paid the Region 1 rate. But there may be some, you know, some sort of special situations. You know, I used the example the other day of a landscaping company, which, you know, maybe it's based in Silverton, but the workers are doing work in, you know, who knows where. The minimum that they are required to be paid will be at whatever rate Silverton is in. On the flip side, you know, if the company is, you know, if they're based in the metro area and, you know, the worker is, you know, doing a day's work somewhere else in the state, they are paid their regular metro area rate. The goal here is to make enforcement easier, frankly, and to make it simpler and more predictable, both for employers and employees. So, you know, they know, everyone knows what the rate of pay is going to be. Okay. So that I think covers pretty much all the elements of it, and I'd be happy to answer questions. Senator Knope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you explain why Josephine and Wasco and Hood River wouldn't qualify as a rural or enterprise county as compared to, or frontier, I think you've referred to them as,
right,
as opposed to some of the other counties with significant population?
Thank you very much for that question. I should have mentioned the whole methodology of how these different, the different regions are established. It's all a function of the cost of living in those areas and the self-sufficiency index for those areas. So, you know, we have tried, you know, as much as possible, and, I think, you know, that's certainly what we tried to do, make it so that those areas that are, you know, where the, you know, what it takes to support yourself and your family is the lowest would be in the lowest schedule. And those where the cost of living is higher, the wage needs to be higher. And, you know, where it's highest, the wage needs to be highest. That's the methodology. And we're trying, you know, to be very sort of data-driven with this. You know, as you know, we've talked about, you know, as part of the whole work group process, we looked at a lot of information that came out of the University of Washington and Portland State about what it took to be self-sufficient in the various counties here in Oregon. So that's that was the purpose and the methodology.
Okay. My second question is in regards to Eastern Oregon.
Yeah.
I know we've created a region, and it's less than what the other two regions will be. But the email or the contact I've received is significantly, from Eastern Oregon, is significantly no on minimum wage, as especially from businesses. We've heard a lot of testimony. And that region, if you put it to the ballot, wouldn't pass a minimum wage increase. And so I'm wondering if we shouldn't take into account a little bit more kind of the testimony and the feedback that we're getting from that region, because some of the things that will happen will be irreversible in terms of some of the industries that will be affected, processing and so on, that will ultimately move out of that area. And there is no replacement for it. And so I just wanted to bring that up because I think it's a significant issue. Now, on the flip side, the emails that I've gotten from the home of my birth and the place you represent, Portland, is about 99% raise the minimum wage and raise it pretty much as high as you can. But that's not what we're getting from Eastern Oregon counties at all. And so I just want to, you know, put that on the record, and if there's something that we can do, I think, to make that region look a little bit more like the testimony that we received, I think that would be incredibly helpful for the region.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, we are one state, and yet we're not one state. I agree with you. And this this proposal is really an attempt to accommodate both of those realities. We are one state, and we, you know, I believe that we need to raise the minimum wage for the entire state. But the rates for the different regions is, you know, an accommodation to the fact that we have different economies in the different regions and different costs in the different regions. So, you know, certainly, you know, I appreciate your suggestion. You know, I can tell you for me at this point, this, you know, what we have here for the region, for region one, is about as, you know, is as low as we can go as far as that goes. You know, because we also have heard, maybe you haven't heard, but I've heard from a lot of workers in those areas who, you know, they too, they need a raise. And so to not give them a raise, you know, I think would be, you know, would be wrong of us.
Well, Mr. Chair, just 14 out of 16 of the past years, there's been a raise under the current minimum wage structure. So it wouldn't be fair to say they haven't received an increase, because they have. So obviously I don't think we're going to make a lot of ground on that issue, but one thing, suggestion I did want to make for your consideration is that this is a long-term phase-in, and during that phase-in, I think everybody here would admit that there's likely to be a recession at some point, just if you look at the cyclical calendar. And so if you have a pre-described phase-in that doesn't include a suspension, if you enter a recession, what you're going to end up doing is shutting jobs quicker, because businesses will see that next raise coming and going, we can't afford what we have now. And so I would encourage you to look at that as a potential option of relief for at some point entering a recession, and taking that into account, because our current system kind of takes that into account, because it's not a given that there'll be an increase. Increases based on CPI. This, however, is prescriptive. It's going to happen no matter what if the law gets passed. And so I think we need to think real carefully about that, because I think there can be some significant detrimental impacts if, and not if, when we hit that recession, because recessions are cyclical with economic cycles. So. That's just a suggestion.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Senator. You know, I will say that, you know, I believe that one of the benefits of what we're doing here, too, is this is a legislative solution, right, as opposed to a ballot measure solution. And the legislature, if it passes this, is responsible for it. And if changes need to be made, you know, if tweaks have to happen in the future, that's the legislative responsibility. That's what we're elected to do. So I appreciate that comment. Any other questions about the plan? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
I guess I would have a question as to what will be the deciding factor on whether this moves tomorrow or not.
I think it takes three votes.
So yeah. They will move tomorrow.
You know, my intention is for us to work this bill tomorrow. But, you know, I certainly was not interested in having us vote on the bill today. This is brand new. We need to mull this over and, you know, have a good night's sleep on it, and then come back and have our debate. And if we're not ready to vote on it tomorrow, then we won't. So,
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And so will this be the only bill on our schedule for tomorrow?
Yes.
And will we be taking any public testimony at all?
I don't believe so.
And I didn't have a chance to talk to you about this before, but it does occur to me that we do have now a new proposal
We didn't even get through all the public testimony that we had at our hearing 2 days ago, and to have no public testimony, I mean, I get that we're not going to be able to stay here all day. I don't think anybody can, but there ought to be some opportunity, it seems like, for some stakeholders to weigh in. And I would, you know, I know we didn't really last time get to hear from an equal number of both sides because of the 100-mile thing, which, you know, I get that people who own businesses can leave their businesses. A lot of workers can't leave during the day to come testify, so it's not much on a day's notice, but it seems like even an hour of testimony or 45 minutes or something.
Yeah. No, I appreciate that. Jan, what are posting notice requirements?
24 hours. You are able to take testimony during a work session if you wish. You can call up anybody you would like to, but we wouldn't, without it being scheduled for a public hearing, we don't put out the witness sheets and invite everyone to sign up. So it's the agenda is out for 1 o'clock. If you wished, we could issue an agenda right now that included a public hearing. It wouldn't be able to start till 1:30, but that's an option.
But just to clarify, Mr. Chair, so there's nothing to prevent us from taking public testimony in a posted work session, though.
Yeah. Okay, why don't we leave it that way, then? Everybody comfortable with that? And let's, you know, let's talk about it.
Mr. Chair, that's fine, but I would support the senator in that, regardless of what position they're in or on this bill, I think they deserve the opportunity to talk about
this particular model.
The new version,
yeah,
and take testimony, and I'll stay here as long as we need to stay tomorrow. I canceled my plans already, so I'll be here all weekend.
I guess I would feel a little bit more comfortable with having it posted as a public hearing, simply to be a little bit more as transparent as we can in this short crunch time period. But if it's just posted for a work session, people are often led to believe that we're not accepting public testimony. So I guess I would like it posted.
Okay, we'll post it for a public hearing then. And but I doubt, well, depending on how many people turn out, we may have to limit the the amount of public testimony. But, okay. Thank you, Jan. All right. Any other questions about it? Okay. Then I will close this work session on Senate Bill 1532, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1544.
And Mr. Chair.
Oh, right.
Yes. As I told you earlier, but just to put it on the record, I would like to, and as will be applying to every bill today, so as to not discriminate, we will be taking an oath or having witnesses take an oath when they come to testify.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Gales.
Thank you. And this is the second committee that I've been in that's had this, and there were just a couple of things that I wanted to mention about it. One, I think this is an area of our statute that we need to look at moving forward to better understand why we have it, how to use it, and how it can accommodate people's religious beliefs. It does not have the ability to affirm. As a Quaker, I can't swear. But I also worry very much about the chilling effect that it has on individuals that may come to the legislature to talk, and words like oath and perjury are big words, and I tend to assume that people come before us and tell the truth. It's my expectation that people are speaking truthfully, but I appreciate that it's there in the notice, and this is not directed at you in general. It's the overall turn of events this week, and I hope there's a time we can look at how that impacts our public process and our accessibility to the general public that might not be able to afford attorneys to advise them.
And Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I don't. If I don't believe we can make the session much longer than it already. It's a compressed period of time, and we do need to depend on testimony, especially from our, you know, officials that come in and testify. And we need to ensure that we're getting correct information. We don't have time to go and verify everything. And though I expect that the public coming in is not, I mean, they're giving their point of view. That's fine, but we're getting facts from especially agencies. We need to make sure that that information is correct.
Well, we're going to be hearing from a lot of people today who are just ordinary people. And if you're insisting that they be under oath, I do think it's going to be disturbing for people. But you do have that right.
Yeah. Well,
just to clarify, there is statute that gives the vice chair the ability to make this request.
Mr. Chair, if we can pick and choose who to give the oath to, we can't. I don't know that we can. I believe that we have to say it is for a hearing on a bill. We can have a discussion with powers that be if you'd like.
My understanding is you can pick and choose.
Yes, it does not need to be everybody.
It doesn't have to be everybody. That has been the problem.
The recent practice of this, recent use of this rule.
That's what we got guidance because we received for our committee that information this weekend. So we spent a lot of time talking with legislative council and others to figure out how does this actually work and what do we need to advise constituents. But we were told that yes, you could pick and choose. You could.
Okay. Can I call a short recess?
Yes. We're going to stand at ease. Please, everyone, relax. Okay, we are back in session, everyone. So before we proceed with this, I think the vice chair's intention is that she will use her discretion to ask for the oath to be administrated selectively and just for registered lobbyists and public employees, right?
Well, just people representing agencies.
People representing agencies. Okay, so those of you who are registered lobbyists or representing public agencies, be prepared. So because we are, the intention is to bring, to put some people under oath, I need to give you some instructions, just general instructions. And those of you who have been to other hearings where this has been done, this will sound familiar to you. So I'm just going to read from it. Oregon's legislature is one of the most open and inclusive in the nation. We hold public hearings on each of our bills and seek input from the public in our committee process. We depend on the information provided to us by the citizens of Oregon. No one can tell us better how the laws we pass affect the people in our state. All we expect in return for your help is that you respect the members of this committee, respect the legislative process, and that you tell us the truth. Whether you are another member of the Legislative Assembly, the director of an agency, a lobbyist, or a member of the general public, we expect for your testimony to be truthful. However, I am concerned that the practice of swearing in witnesses will have a chilling effect on the willingness of everyday Oregonians to participate in the process of making their laws. And therefore, I appreciate that everyday Oregonians will not have to do this. But for those of you who will have to testify under oath, I need to caution you about a few things. The vice chair is within her rights to swear you in. Although the oath will actually be administered by our committee administrator, Jan Norland. But you, too, have rights. First of all, you don't have to swear the oath. You cannot testify. You can walk away if you choose. You can choose to have an attorney present with you. You can avail yourself of your Fifth Amendment rights. That is, including the right not to give testimony against yourself. And if you tell the truth, nothing you say to this committee, whether you have sworn an oath or not, can be used against you in any state proceeding. You should know, however, that this immunity does not extend to any federal legal proceeding that may be brought against you, including a federal criminal proceeding. If you testify under oath and do not tell the truth, you could be charged with the crime of perjury. Perjury is a Class C felony and carries a maximum possible sentence of 5 years imprisonment, a $125,000 fine, or both. It's up to the Marion County District Attorney, however, whether to proceed with any charges for perjury. Okay? So with that, I'm going to call up our first witness.
And you have opened the public hearing, correct?
I believe that I did, yes.
Yes, she said, okay. Yes.
Okay. So I'm going to call up Kate Newhall, Ryan Tribbett, and John Molis.
And Mr. Chair, I'll just start off reminding the committee what this measure is. This is a measure that increases the maximum number of weeks from 5 to 10 for which an unemployed individual participating in an apprenticeship program is eligible for unemployment insurance benefits. It declares an emergency. There are no amendments before you. We have received from fiscal office a minimal expenditure impact report and from revenue a minimal revenue impact report.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So please raise your right.
No, hold just a sec.
Oh, John.
John, this is your moment.
He might ask him if he understands his rights.
Yeah.
He was out of the room.
Right. John, you were out of the room. Did you understand your rights as far as being put under oath?
I do.
Yeah.
I heard your earlier conversation. I'm perfectly fine with that.
Thank you.
Okay, then I would ask you to raise your right hand. Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you are about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Committee on Workforce and General Government shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
I do.
Okay, great. Colleagues, this is a bill that we had an informational hearing on this problem and on this proposed bill, I think back in November. Comes before you now in draft form. I think everyone up here is a sponsor of this bill. Kate, do you want to begin?
Yes. So for the record, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today representing the Sheet Metal Contractors Association and SMART Local 16, the sheet metal workers. So what you have before you in Senate Bill 1544, I like to say, is a relatively simple concept, and actually I think very rarely can you solve two issues with one word change in statute. So as you'll recall from the November hearing, what this bill does essentially is increase the number of weeks that apprentices can claim unemployment insurance when they are off the job for their related classroom instruction. So we are increasing the number of weeks from what's currently in statute of 5 weeks to 10 weeks. And the reason that we're making that increase is that because for the sheet metal apprentices, they actually have 6 weeks of required training in the first and second years of their five-year program. So this bill and change will allow them to get unemployment insurance for the entire time that they're off the job for their instruction. Granted, they still have the waiting week, just like every other person claiming unemployment insurance has the waiting week. The second issue that this bill addresses and solves is that it gives some flexibility to the apprenticeship programs as it relates to changing the dates of their training each year. So because unemployment insurance is based on the benefit year, which starts the very first day an individual files an unemployment insurance claim and is the 12-month period after that first day that they file, if, for example, a program wants to change its training from year to year, if they wanted to move, say, from the first year they start their training, February 1st of 2016, but then next year, for whatever reason, they decide that they want to start their training January 1st of 2017. And in that scenario, what you'd have is 2 full years of training that technically falls within the same benefit year. So that's the reason that we want to go to 10 weeks, is so that the apprenticeship programs that do this kind of consolidated training do have some flexibility in their ability to just change their dates around for, you know, whatever reasons that come up with the calendar, through holidays, different vacation schedules. So for that reason, I appreciate that all of you have co-sponsored this bill. I think it is a good bill, and I'm excited to see it happen for not just our apprentices, but all the apprentices that do consolidated training. Thank you.
Thank you, Kate. Ryan.
For the record, Ryan Tribbett here today representing Ironworkers Local 29. Our union falls into the sort of latter category, the second category that Ms. Newell described, where our program is a five-week program, but yeah, under a benefit year calculation, basically you could never do it earlier the previous year. You'd always have to go later in the calendar year to be able to do the training without sort of taking a week off or something from the apprentices. That happened a couple of years ago. Unfortunately, we inadvertently had scheduled it earlier in the calendar than the previous year, and apprentices were unable to file for an extra couple of weeks, and we want to avoid that situation. It doesn't actually increase a fiscal one little bit, and the calendar year designation will still be filing the same 5 weeks each time. It just allows some flexibility in planning. So we thank you for sponsoring, and I urge an aye vote. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. John Molis with the Oregon Building Trades Council. And I've, when this concept came up and this issue, I surveyed all my affiliates, and these two are the only ones that this will apply to currently. The rest of them either do it a week at a time or at nights, and so it's very minimal. But for the apprentices who potentially have been going to classes and not having any source of income, it'll be a big deal to them. So again, I appreciate all your support, and I hope the bill will pass. Thank you.
Great. Colleagues, do you have any questions of the panel? Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you. John, it seems like this is a familiar topic. I want to say in a previous century, when I was in the House, this came up. And so this is not the first time we've seen this, right?
Chair Dembro, Senator Knope, I just started doing this in 2011, so you have to ask my predecessor. I honestly do not know.
Hey, do you know?
If I may, I did pull the legislative history just sort of on the statute, and so yes, the statute was last changed in 1999, and I believe you're a House member at that point. And so the statute was changed at that point in time to go from 3 weeks to 5 weeks. And I think one of the reasons that the change over time has been necessary is kind of twofold. One, I think all of the programs are noticing that they have to do a lot more remedial education with folks. That's one of the reasons that also we have all worked really hard on career technical education and investments. I think we have also seen the nature of the construction industry just get more technologically advanced. So extra training has become necessary.
Yeah, thanks for that, Kate. Another factor perhaps is that more and more training is happening in a central location. Is that right? Where, you know, it used to be they might have been more regional, so someone could be working and then, you know, going to school. Now more of it happens at a central location. They have to travel and so take time off from work.
And that's
what I've heard.
That's exactly the situation. Excuse me, for the sheet metal workers, they have a training center in Springfield and one in Portland. And for apprentices who are working in regions farther away than that, that's true. They do. They come into the regional training centers and do all their training.
Great. Okay, thank you all.
Thank you.
Colleagues, any other questions? I could call up someone from the employment department if need be. But
I think we were all here during the interim. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, so is there anyone else that wants to speak to this bill? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1544, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1544. Vice Chair Thatcher?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1544 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher moves Senate Bill 1544 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of the measure? Is there any objection to the measure? Seeing none. The measure is adopted. Approved. Okay, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1544.
Do you want to name the carrier for that measure?
I'll carry it. Thank you. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1508. John, were you going to speak to this? Again, this is the MLAC. And Teresa. Welcome, both of you. John, you've already been sworn in, and I would say that you're still under oath. But, Teresa, this is your chance.
Would you raise your right hand, please? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you are about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Committee on Workforce and General Government shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Jen, could you tell us about this bill?
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 1508 increases from 2 years to 3 years the term of appointment for members of the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee, known as MLAC. There are no amendments. There are no fiscal or revenue impacts on this measure, no subsequent referral.
Okay. And, colleagues, this was a committee bill, I believe, from the, what's it called, Business and Economic Development Committee, I think.
I think that's right.
Anyway, just for some
Senate
background.
Senate Business and Transportation.
Business and Transportation. That's it. Wrong chamber. Okay, welcome. Tell us why we need to do this, Teresa.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Teresa Van Winkle, Senior Policy Advisor for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm actually here under my other job duty, which is I am the Administrator for the Workers' Compensation Management Advisory Committee, or more commonly known as MLAC. You have in front of you Senate Bill 1508, and in OLIS you do have some background on the bill and an overview of MLAC and its history, so I won't go into detail on that. What the bill does is that it changes the current statutory term of members from 2 years to 3 years. The background behind this is that under current statute, the terms for MLAC members runs contrary to the majority of the boards and commissions that are subject to the governor's executive appointments process. And given the complexities of workers' compensation regulation and the duties of MLAC members, there's a learning curve for the vast majority of committee members. Not to put Senator Rosenbaum on the spot as a former MLAC member, but there's that. So since my time as being the administrator for MLAC, a number of members on their way out of their membership duties have expressed their an issue of being able to comfortable of working on these issues right at the time that their departure time. There's also been a number of stakeholders, both on management and labor, who have expressed their concerns about the turnover of membership due to the term limits. So thanks to the current co-chair, Mr. Mullis, the MLAC members had started the process of what's in front of you today. So this bill, like other bills in front as dealing with workers' compensation, has gone through the MLAC process. There's been ample opportunity for stakeholders to provide input. There's no known opposition to the bill. And just to be clear, the bill has not received MLAC vote on this. It should, pending quorum issues, take place tomorrow.
Thank you,
and we ask for your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Great. Thank you very much. And, John, so I assume that you want to extend your time on MLAC, and that's why you're here to support this, right?
Chair Denbrough, I hate to disagree with you in the public, but that would be incorrect.
Okay. I was saying, Mr. Chair, I can
follow. And remember, you are under oath here.
Yeah, I was going to say, Mr. Chair, even if he wanted to, he cannot. It applies for two members that are appointed after the January 2017. So. I'm sorry for you, Mr. Mullis.
Good afternoon, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, John Mullis. And when I speak on Senate Bill 1508, I'm doing so as one member of the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee. And I've served on a number of boards and commissions over the years, and some are two-year terms, and some are three, and some are four. And we had discussion, and I think everybody agrees that two is too short if you're limited to two terms. Workers' compensation is very complex, and just about when you start learning it at the end of 2 years, then you've got one more two-year term to serve. So I think this will be good for workers. I think it'll be good for employers. I think it'll be good for the system at large. So I urge your support. And I understand the need for refreshing and getting new people on and new ideas. There's also value to institutional knowledge. So I think this threads the needle pretty well. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher.
Well, since it's usual that and customary that we pass these types of bills after a vote from MLEC, are we going to do it in anticipation, or what's the timing on this?
Teresa, what do you say?
Sure, Chair Denver, Vice Chair Thatcher. I think I will remove my bias as the Administrator of the Committee. Since the bill was developed with all the membership, and the members have to actually, in order for the bill to be introduced on behalf of MLEC, they do take a vote. So in theory,
Okay.
I think in my capacity as Minister, I think yes, since there's no unknown issues, I would feel comfortable doing that. And if there happens to be an issue that comes up, it can be taken up in the House.
Chair Denver, Senator Thatcher, I would agree.
Great.
This has been very well vetted by all the stakeholders, I believe.
Okay, thank you. We really rely on MLEC a lot on this committee, so thank you very much. Do we have anyone else who signed up to speak? Betsy Earls, please.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you understood the rights that you had?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Is that it?
So please raise your right hand. Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you are about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Committee on Workforce and General Government shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? So help you God.
I do. This is going to be very short after that dramatic introduction, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing before you in favor of Senate Bill 1508. I think everybody remembers last session we worked on at least one fairly significant piece of workers' compensation legislation, and there are a couple of other, it's not too loud, fairly significant issues probably coming in the future. We had a rather weak MLAC last session just because we had some open spots and some very inexperienced members at the time. And I think everybody that was involved in the process felt that longer terms to give people more of a chance to understand the intricacies of the workers' compensation system would really help, maintain the consistent strength of the MLAC intellect, if you will. And so we do support this bill. We would probably support longer terms, but I understand there's a balance between, people's willingness to commit and people's, intellectual capacity to absorb this kind of information. So we are urging your support. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Betsy. Any questions for Ms. Earls? Well, we have to be really careful since she's under oath.
I'll be back.
A lot of questions we'd like to ask you.
Other belts.
Thank you very much. Okay, so with that, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1508. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1508.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1508 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher has moved Senate Bill 1508 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of this measure?
Just briefly,
Senator.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say I do support this bill, and having served on MLEC myself quite a few years ago, I think exactly what the witnesses said, and everybody who's on this committee has listened to workers' compensation legislation through the years. It is extremely technical, and once you learn it, you're part of a very small group of people who don't generally want to see each other at parties, but definitely have a lot. But definitely have a lot to contribute to our dealing with changes that are proposed here. And also wanted to just thank people who've served, including John Molis, who I think is coming to an end of his time because I noticed that we're going to be confirming a couple of new appointees, including somebody replacing him next week. So I think it's a great idea to do this.
I noticed he was getting a little lighter in his step.
Thank you very much, Senators. Any further discussion of this measure? Okay. Is there any opposition to the measure? Okay. The measure is adopted. I think it's only fair that we ask Senator Rosenbaum to carry this. Thank you.
I'd be happy to.
So I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1508, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1534. And we have Tricia Smith and David Could you come up as well, David Gerstenfeld? Yes, please explain the bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Senate Bill 1534, it allows school employees who provide services that are other than instructional research or the principal administration to receive unemployment insurance benefits without interruption during school breaks and recesses if that individual voluntarily left work with good cause. Provides that any provision found to be out of conformity with federal laws to no longer be in effect, declares an emergency on passage. There are no amendments before you, there's no revenue impact, and there's a minimal expenditure impact.
Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, go ahead.
All right, would you raise your right hand, please? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Committee on Workforce and General Government shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
So help me, fairy godmother.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. So, colleagues, this bill will be familiar to you. We passed a very similar version of it last term. By the time it went over to the House, we realized we had a federal problem, and we still have a federal problem. We're waiting to hear back from the federal government about what we're doing here. And just to remind you, this is to deal with the problem of people who've been on unemployment, and then we get into a break period like the summer, and their unemployment payments stop until the holiday is over, and then they resume. And everyone that I've talked to thinks this is crazy, but it is what it is. And so we're hoping to be able to change it. And if we pass this, we believe we can get a determination from the federal government. So, Tricia, you want to talk about the need, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. And this bill is, with one exception, the bill that you all voted in favor of, Senate Bill 470A, last session. The exception is that this bill, Senate Bill 1534, has an escape clause. As you know, if states pass laws that are in conflict with federal unemployment law, according to the Department of Labor, the entire trust fund is in jeopardy. And so we want to make sure that that is not ever the case as we continue the discussions with the staff at the Department of Labor around the issue of classified school employees and their continuation of unemployment insurance during summer and winter breaks. In the case of Senate Bill 1534, this, as Senator Denbrough said, is a very tiny group of people that we're talking about. The department estimated last year that it would affect about 93 people out of the 30,000 school employees who might be eligible. So as you can see, it is a very small group. I wanted to point out one thing about my written testimony. I neglected to put in the chapter cite in the Oregon Administrative Rule, which describes what good cause is. And the cite in my fourth bullet point should read OAR 471-030-0038. Sub 4. So I apologize for that typographical error. You will notice in that paragraph, at the end of the paragraph, it pretty much, if you're wondering what is good cause? Good cause is when a person voluntarily leaves work for reasons that just simply can't be avoided, that are a good reason, good cause. And the administrative rule describes it as such that a reasonable and prudent person of normal sensitivity exercising ordinary common sense would leave work. And the last phrase in the last line is, for all individuals, the reason must be so of such gravity that the individual has no reasonable alternative but to leave work. And this is not decided by the employee or the employer, it's decided by the employment department. They look at the circumstances and they determine whether or not this is the case. And if they do, then school employees, these school employees would receive unemployment insurance. Now, these are not teachers or administrators we're talking about, just classified. But under today's law, they would receive the unemployment insurance just like everyone else right up until the time school's out for the summer. And then, unlike everyone else, their benefit ends. And so this bill will stop that in what we consider to be an injustice for these folks.
Thank you, Tricia. David, do you have anything to add?
Chair Gembro, members of the committee, for the record, David Gerstenfeld, overseeing the unemployment insurance program at the Employment Department. I think this accurately summarizes it. I wanted to correct one technicality, that the money in the trust fund is not put at risk for out of conformity with federal law, but all of the funds that we receive from the federal government to administer the unemployment insurance program, and importantly, a tax credit that all Oregon employers receive against their federal unemployment tax obligation is put at risk. That's approximately $500 million a year of potential additional employer taxes. So that's why we want to make sure that we have that escape provision so that those consequences don't come to pass if the bill passes and the Department of Labor says it's inconsistent with federal requirements.
Thank you.
And yes, Mr. Chair, since I did swear by my fairy godmother, I do hope that you won't put me in jail for my little error about the trust fund. It was inadvertent.
Okay. colleagues, any questions? Let me just ask, we're talking about a very rare kind of thing, right? I mean, this is infrequent. It's hard for me actually to articulate what an example might be. I don't know, David, do you have any example? Could you give us an example?
Certainly, Chair Dembro, and it is relatively infrequent. We are looking at about around 90 a biennium, so it's not a lot given the number of people that do at some point seek unemployment insurance benefits. A scenario might be someone who my spouse has to move out of the area, and to preserve my relationship, we move our household. I can no longer work for the school district that I used to, so I have good cause to leave my job. I'm receiving unemployment insurance benefits during the spring, but then when the summer recess for where I used to work hits, my unemployment insurance benefits would stop and would not, if I'm still unemployed when the next term starts, I'd be able to resume, but during that summer break, I would not be eligible to get unemployment.
Mm-hmm. If you found work in the interim, your benefits would cease anyway, right?
Correct.
And you have to continue to look for work, sure, just like any other person on unemployment.
Right. Colleagues, any questions?
I just have a question for
yes.
you, and maybe they can clarify if you don't know the answer. But if we, you're saying, am I understanding correctly, that in order to get a decision from the federal government, we would have to pass it?
My understanding is that it's much more likely that we'll get an advisory comment from them if they're dealing with an existing law.
Okay, I see.
Chair Dembro, the Department of Labor does make a formal conformity determination for each state's program each year. So if a bill is passed, they do look at every bill that is passed and say if it's consistent or not. We have a pretty good relationship and are usually able to get informal opinions prior to that. We've had some informal discussions with the Department of Labor where they continue to express some concerns. We have requested a formal conformity determination, which they can do without the bill being passed, but we really have no idea when that would be, and it may well be after this session would be over.
And if they say no, then the escape clause in the bill kicks in.
Correct, Chair Dembro.
Right. Okay.
Well, I guess one more question.
Yeah.
Then. If say, one of those 93 people per biennium qualifies to receive this unemployment before this determination is made, what happens?
Chair Dembro, Senator Thatcher, in that circumstance, if we're administering it in a way that the Department of Labor says is not consistent with federal law, but it's before they've officially told us that, the bad consequences do not come to pass. So we do not lose our administrative funding. Oregon employers retain their tax credit. They essentially tell us that we need to stop administering things that are inconsistent with federal law.
And they're not going to follow up? And they're not going, you're not going to go, like, ask for your money back or something? I just From the person who received unemployment.
That's correct, Chair. Senator Thatcher. In this situation, we would have paid the benefits according to state law, so it's not an overpayment that we would ask for the benefits back. We would just have to change how we how the state law works from that point on.
Okay, thank you both very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Do we have anyone else who's signed up? No.
That's it.
All right, then. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1534, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1534.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1534 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Thatcher moves Senate Bill 1534 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, colleagues? Okay, is there any opposition to our passing this motion? Seeing none, the motion is passed. Vice Chair Thatcher, you did it last time. You want to do it again?
Sure.
Okay. Vice Chair Thatcher will carry. The work session is closed. Okay, now I will open our public hearing on Senate Bill 1587, and this is the wage enforcement bill. And let me lead it off for you, because I'm the chief sponsor of this. I'm going to do it up here if nobody minds. We have, when we had our last hearing, which was during Ledge Days a couple of weeks ago, we had a long hearing on the subject of wage theft and touched on this bill that we were working on. I mentioned that this is a bill that we've been working on for quite some time, that essentially what we did was took pieces from bills on the House side and the Senate side from last time that for whatever reason didn't make it to passage, put them together in the quest of reaching some consensus around the bill and the elements in this bill. And we've been working in a work group kind of context, meeting with stakeholders, trying to find areas of agreement where we could come up with something that would help with this terrible problem that we heard about last time of wage theft, where people are deprived of the wages that they're owed. And, you know, we talked a lot about, the fact that there are, most people are good actors, most employers are good actors, but there are some bad actors. And we want to come up with a way of discouraging bad action, and even to the point of putting those bad actors out of business if necessary, or in this bill, even in extreme cases, opening them up to criminal charges. So, what you have before you is the bill as introduced, but I have requested amendments based on all the conversations that I've had that we'll obviously have before us before we work the bill. But I wanted to go over with you and just put on the record the different elements that are being sought in the amendments. List of changes, I think, is on OLIS, actually. What's being requested in the amendments. First of all, Section 2, there was, and that has to do with responsibility of employers to provide a worker who's been dismissed with time and pay records when they, when they are dismissed. And articulates that the worker has the right to ask for them, and the employer is expected to deliver them. In the original form of the bill, there was a private right of action attached to to the situation to compel an employer or help compel an employer to turn those records over. That has been deleted, the private right of action piece. But, you know, the employers are expected to turn over those time and pay records. And, of course, the worker can go to BOLI with a complaint, and then the employer will have to turn them over. And the employee can always choose to bring suit against the employer, in which case those time and pay records will have to be delivered through disclosure. But the private right of action, which was a real concern for employer representatives, has been removed in these amendments. The issue of how long time and pay records need to be retained was an area of dispute, and what we're doing is clarifying that the retention period is aligned with what's currently required in the federal code, 3 years for payroll records. The section of the bill having to do with expanding BOLI's ability to require an employer to post a bond for wages has been deleted. The part of the bill that has to do with enhancing BOLI's ability to do enforcement, including spot checks and more prompt response to complaints through adding three positions through the Wage Security Fund has been clarified. That is still in there. I believe it's a really strong part of this bill, and some sideboards are being requested to make it clear that these are for three additional positions, and the purpose is to enforce wage violations. And then finally, in the part of the bill that has to do with egregious violations of prevailing wage law, and we heard at least one horrendous story about this last time involving an ATM machine, if you remember that. We are modifying the language. This is kind of it's essentially a technical fix that in the original bill, the threshold was either 25% of wages due to the employee or $1,000. Now the threshold is 25% of wages and $1,000, and the parties all agree to that change. So, I believe that this amendment will address a number of the concerns raised by employers. It'll make state law consistent with what's already required of employers by BOLI rule and by federal code, and it retains important protections for workers on prevailing wage job sites. It also ensures that every worker receives a detailed pay stub and provides, as I mentioned, three additional positions to BOLI to crack down on wage theft. So those are the amendments. I believe that it solves the major issues that were out there when we were working in our work group. You may hear differently from people who come up and speak. I do believe that this is a real step forward for us. Will these changes solve the problem of wage theft in this state? Clearly not. But I believe that it will, advance the effort and make some very important improvements in our efforts to catch violators early, to help our state agency who's responsible for this be more responsive, and ultimately protect workers much more than they are currently. So with that, I'm going to call up our first panel, and let's hear from Boley, so Paloma and Gerhardt, you want to come back up? And Michael Dale? Boy, Michael, are you a registered lobbyist?
I am.
Okay, then all three of you. Go ahead, Jan.
And raise your right hand, please. Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Committee on Workforce and General Government shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from Boley first, your response to the amendments to the bill?
Good afternoon, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. For the record, Paloma Sparks with Bureau of Labor and Industries. The Bureau is always supportive of any effort to crack down on wage theft, to try and make sure that workers are always paid what they have earned. We think that we could do a really great job with the additional three positions at the Bureau. When you go from 7 to 10, that's a big jump for us. Clarifying that the Oregon state law will match up with federal law also makes sense to us, and we're happy to help in any other way we can. And Gerhardt is here to explain more sort of about how we might use the positions, so I'll sort of wait for you to ask him about that.
Gerhardt, could you tell us how Boley will use these positions? Thank you.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, thank you for that question. As you probably know, Boley's wage enforcement at the moment is largely restricted to...
Excuse me, sorry, Gerhardt. Sure. Could you give us your name for the record, please?
My name is Gerhardt Teubel. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at Boley.
Thank you.
As I was saying, Boley's wage enforcement at the moment is largely restricted to a reactive approach. That is, we're responding to mostly to individual wage claims that are filed by workers, largely after those workers have terminated their employment with an employer and come to us and identify problems that existed during their employment. I think these additional resources, should the legislature allocate those to Boley, could be successfully used to implement a more proactive approach to wage enforcement in the state of Oregon by Boley, who is the primary agency for doing that. From my perspective, I think this could be accomplished because we do know from the wage claims that we receive and the complaints that we receive where the areas of concern are. I testified before you a couple of weeks ago about the areas where we largely receive wage claims. And additional resources would allow us to more proactively enter into those areas, perhaps conduct audits or additional site visits to both gauge compliance in the workplace and then address problems as they are occurring, rather than waiting for a worker necessarily to file a wage claim. So at this time, that's sort of where our thoughts are leading us as far as how we might deploy any additional resources we should receive. Thank you.
Thank you. Michael.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough and members of the committee. My name is Michael Dale. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Workers Justice Project, and I'm here representing the Oregon Coalition Against Wage Theft and Fair Shot. The 40 organizations who are members of the Oregon Coalition to Stop Wage Theft opted to join a series of meetings beginning during the 2015 session under the leadership of Chair Denbrough, and over the interim that involved members of our coalition and the business lobby to try to find a common approach to addressing the serious problem that wage theft presents to Oregon families, communities, and to those employers who try to do the right thing and have to compete with people who are not. We tried to be flexible yet realistic about the likely effects of any provision, what it might have moving forward in terms of really having an effect on this serious issue. We've been interested in real solutions and not symbolic gestures. Unfortunately, we found that the business lobby pretty much at every turn has pretty shamelessly opposed every provision that we felt would make much of it any difference. I'm sure their perspective might be different, but that's what we perceived. Given that reality and given the limitations of a special session, we endorsed a very modest set of proposals reflected in Senate Bill 1587. Many of our member organizations have expressed support either in open or in written testimony for that bill, and we continue to endorse that bill as it was written. We do not, however, support the amendments that are being proposed to Senate Bill 1587. It was a deep compromise from our original position, and that compromise was made only because of the constraints of the short session. The amendments, the dash one, I guess they're not dash one amendments yet because they haven't been drafted, but the amendments discussed don't represent compromise. Rather, the requirement that this bill have bipartisan support has essentially required capitulation to the positions the business lobby has taken from the very beginning of the talks. If Senate Bill 1587 is amended as proposed, it is our judgment that it will do very little to advance compliance with the law. Boldy certainly needs more enforcement positions. We agree with that and support that. During the 1980s temporary recession, Boley resources were decimated and have never recovered. Today, Boley has about half the resources to enforce wage theft laws as survived into 1991 after the severe cuts. To restore Boley even to these reduced levels would require about $9 million, about doubling the wage and hour division budget. And this would not reopen closed offices in Bend, in Pendleton, or in Medford. Three more positions is helpful, but there's such a drop in the bucket, it is our perception that this will not seriously move the dial in this area. The notion pushed by the business lobby that wage theft can be seriously addressed through state administrative regulation is fundamentally misguided. We don't believe that it will work, and this pitiful increase in resources certainly won't be successful in doing so. Business, when it has disputes, does not expect to have those disputes mediated by the government. It expects to be able to take those disputes directly into the courts if necessary, through negotiation, through mediation, through arbitration, whatever means are available. They expect to be represented by their own lawyers, and workers deserve no less. We also understand and support the desire of the building trades for more meaningful sanctions for fraud in prevailing wage contracts. These proposals have some merit. They just won't help very much. Therefore, if the amendments being proposed are adopted, our efforts as a coalition will move to consideration of how to achieve truly robust improvements in wage compliance in the 2017 session. To be clear, we look for measures that put tools in the hands of workers, their unions, community organizations, and attorneys to better collect their wages themselves on their own without having to rely on government for help in doing so. Since an amended Senate Bill 1587 would not meet those criteria, our position will be neutral on the bill if it's so amended.
Thank you, Michael. Colleagues, any questions for this panel?
I did have one question. I was curious when you said you know the areas where you need to concentrate resources for discovering wage theft. I think that's how I understood it. When you say areas, are you talking about industries or actual regions physically, or are you talking about particular businesses, or all of the above?
Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Thatcher. we certainly by industry, we know from the complaints that we receive and the wage claims that we receive against these businesses, we know what industries those businesses represent. From the information we have, we can look geographically too to see where these businesses are, but largely a lot of the businesses, for obvious reasons, are in the metro areas of the state. So our thinking is more looking on a probably on an industry basis and then concentrating our efforts where we see the majority of wage claims being filed as areas of probably more likely, there's more likely occurrence of violations happening there than, say, in other industries where we don't receive a lot of complaints or claims.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Clarification.
And you currently have 7 staff to do this kind of oversight. Is that right, Gerhard?
Chairman Denver, that's currently we have 7. You may remember with the sick time bill, we got another compliance specialist, which will be coming on board soon for that that program.
Okay, thank you, panel. Okay, I'll call up Betsy Earls, Anthony Smith, and Jael Wilson, please. Jael here? Okay, then I'll call up John Rakowitz. It's your lucky day, John. Betsy, you're still under oath, but the two others are not.
Would you raise your right hand, please? Under penalty of perjury, do you solemnly swear that the evidence you're about to give in the matter now pending before the Senate Committee on Workforce and General Government shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Betsy, you want to start?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls, again representing Associated Oregon Industries, appearing before you on Senate Bill 1587. The business community, I think all three of us here, also participated in the work groups that Mr. Dale mentioned in his prior testimony to address the problem of wage theft in Oregon. And I think one of the things that was very clear in those meetings was that there are really broad areas of agreement about the wage theft problem in this state. Nobody disagrees with the idea that employers who take advantage of their workers by stealing their pay should be sanctioned. And none of us disagree that when employees are cheated in this fashion, the impact on those employees can be devastating. Obviously, where we differ and where we have differed is in our approach to the problem. And our position is and has been that the employers who are cheating their employees of their wages are breaking the law right now, and adding additional parameters or additional laws is not going to make them any less willing to break those laws as well. So the compromise that we brought forward, or the offer that we brought forward, which I didn't think was shameless at the time, was that we spend employer money out of the wage security fund to fund some additional enforcement specialists to help Boley try and get to the, I wouldn't say the bottom, but get more into the wage theft problem and have an impact on dealing with the people that are actually causing the problem without sweeping in other employers who aren't actually causing problems in the wage theft area. So I do appreciate the compromise, the draft compromise that's been brought forward. I think that there have been some really good changes made, and there obviously are some things that we're still concerned about in that, but I don't know if it's worth going into those on the record right now. We can probably work through those if you choose to go forward, Mr. Chair. So unless you have more questions about those, I'll leave it there for now.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Smith, welcome to the committee.
Chair Denbro, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Anthony K. Smith. I'm the Oregon State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. NFIB represents small and independent businesses across the country, all 50 state capitals in Washington, D.C., and really the smallest of small businesses. I'm here today to oppose SB 1587 in its current form. But before I briefly discuss our concerns on the bill, I want to be very clear that neither NFIB nor any business group that I'm aware of supports wage theft or any other illegal business practices that cheat workers out of pay that they have rightfully earned. I think that goes without saying. That being said, SB 1587 as written, and that's what I'm here to discuss today, is as written. I did see the amendment. But at least we have one panelist from the previous panel who supports the bill as written, and I think that I'd like to address the bill as it is in its current form today. It creates new regulations on Oregon small businesses, regulations that law-abiding businesses would have to comply with no guarantees that those already violating the law would change their bad behavior. I was recently encouraged by statements that Governor Brown made when she released her 2016 agenda, and she made comments like Oregon needs to develop ways for small businesses to spend more time serving customers and less time navigating state policies and procedures, more black ink and less red tape. And even though I believe the supporters of SB 1587 are well-intended, I think this is close to a red tape bill. As written, SB 1587 would significantly broaden the number and type of records that employers must turn over upon request. These records are already discoverable in civil actions, and most attorneys advise their clients to turn such records over without court order. It would create a new private right of action against employers for not providing these records upon request. Even if the employer is able to prove that they did not violate the law, they will still have to spend time and money defending such a claim. Oregon small businesses should not be forced to enter into costly litigation when they have not participated in wage theft. And the bill as written would grant broad new rulemaking expenditure authority to BOLI, including a drastic change in the bonding provisions in Section 3 and 4 on pages 5 and 6 of the bill as written. And most of that new language replaces references with the commissioner, creating a scenario where businesses are denied impartial due process in court until the very end stages of the process. And Boley will tell you those cases are very rare. And I think that being the case, and recognizing that our legal system is set up in a way to intentionally protect the due process rights of the accused, we should be extremely cautious when considering whether to grant Boley this authority. Again, on behalf of the thousands of small businesses in Oregon, I ask you to oppose SB 1587 in its current form and continue to look for solutions that more narrowly address the bad actors out there without creating additional burdens for honest and hardworking small businessmen and women.
Thank you. Thank you, Anthony. Mr. Rakowitz.
Yes. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, John Rakowitz with AGC, Associated General Contractors. We represent a very broad cross-section of commercial construction across the state, small, medium, large, open union, all types of building all over the state of Oregon. The testimony that came before this committee in January was compelling testimony. In fact, I'll go so far as to say I agree with Betsy, but I'll go so far as to say in our industry, in the construction industry, this is a practical matter. Forget the moral aspect of this. It undermines legitimate contractors and creates a competitive disadvantage when people don't play by the rules. So it's very clear to us we have no interest as an industry in those people continue to play in that manner. So I just want to be on the record for that. Despite all that, for many of the reasons that have just been mentioned, we oppose the original bill. But I want to focus more on how promising and how much progress has been made. I want to tip my hat to Senator Dembrough. There have been a lot of long discussions, a lot of hours put in to what look like the amendments that are being brought forward will produce. We still are doing our due diligence. We just saw them today. We want to make sure, one, that there's good sideboards and specific purposes associated with the new enforcement staff. That's key to us. We certainly, the Wage Security Fund has another purpose, generally speaking, and that is to pay people when they are no longer have an employer and they've got a place to go. So we want to be careful about that. And in particular, the last piece that is specific to my industry. And you had compelling testimony from Dan Harmon with Hoffman of one or two very egregious examples. The industry and Dan Harmon have had conversations the last 2 days. We are looking at that. We think there may need to be a detail or two added, for instance, in that. Not that the concept is wrong, but If somebody is that far over the line, then that's a different story, and this type of sanction should be out there and hopefully does act as a disincentive. But, for instance, in what 25%, in what period of time? There's nothing said in the current draft. So we're going to be looking at that language, and my request today is that we that as the industry agrees to language, that we can bring that forward and get serious consideration for any details in that particular aspect, Section 6 of the law, as a part of any amendments that might be going forward. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay. We'll need you to do that quickly, John.
We have a meeting scheduled tomorrow with a very experienced attorney. By Monday, we should have language.
End of tomorrow would be better.
Okay, we'll see what we can do.
Sorry, folks, technicalities. Any questions of this panel? Okay, thank you very much, all three of you. Okay, I'm going to call up our last panel. John Molis, please. John Calhoun and Bonnie Colburn. And fortunately, John is already under oath, and our other two witnesses don't need to be. So, John, can we start with you?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Molis. I represent the Oregon Building Trades Council. And I'm here this afternoon just to speak to the prevailing wage portions of House Bill 1587. And as you referenced in your opening remarks, this is an idea that came forward from Hoffman Construction. Dan Harmon's been down here a couple of times. He was in the last legislative days a few weeks ago. And this originated as a bill that came late, very late in the last session. That was a standalone bill. It passed the Senate and then ran out of time in the House. And so I'm going to limit my remarks to just that portion of the bill. And in your opening remarks, you detailed the ATM case, which there was three subcontractors that Hoffman used on separate projects that they found gross violations of wage theft, and not just, you know, a simple misclassification of a worker from a, you know, a bricklayer to a laborer, or, you know, working 40 hours or getting paid 38. In the ATM case, they were literally, you know, giving their workers their checks, marching them down to an ATM, having them cash them, and giving half the money back. And so Mr. Harmon came up with this idea, brought it to me, and I helped him move it forward. Again, that's the reason that we're here today, and we support it. And I know that he does support the one technical change that you've offered for this specific portion in the amendments. I'll close there and answer, or do my best to answer any questions that I could.
Thanks, Jim. Bonnie, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. I am here simply representing as an individual who lives here in Salem, and I took time off of work to be here because with the work that I do, I've been supporting families who are very vulnerable, and it's... It's something that's really...
Bonnie, I have to interrupt you.
Sorry.
If you could just give us your name.
For the record, I'm Bonnie Colburn.
Thank you.
Thank you. I am, as I said, I have for the last 5 years been working with families who are in poverty and families who are oftentimes the vulnerable because of having criminal records. They're the families who are oftentimes at risk for this because they have a lot to lose. And so this is really dear to my heart, to think of creating a system that is better support for them, to be able to advocate for themselves, and to be able to just have the, even just the simple request of a pay stub when you leave seems like a very simple thing that should already be in place. So thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. Calhoun, welcome.
Hi, my name is John Calhoun. I'm from Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon Center for Christian Voices. And I want to say that the faith community sees wage theft for what it simply is, a stealing. And I think all of you are familiar with the Ten Commandments. One of them is, thou shalt not steal. There are a lot of other Bible passages, and I won't read them to you, save you the Sunday school lesson, but they talk frequently about protecting laborers and paying what they're due. I'm also a small businessman, and in that, with that hat on, I want to say that providing the wage information that is in this bill is a trivial exercise with today's payroll services. In my business, we use QuickBooks, the payroll service that we use through Intuit, the manufacturer or supplier of QuickBooks. You put in the name, you print it out, all the records are there. I personally do not see what the problem is with enforcing that and saying that an employer ought to do it. It is not a big red tape issue. I disagree with the statements here that that's a complicated issue for business with today's software. And I'm not talking about big company software. I'm talking about small business software. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Any questions for this panel? Okay, thank you, all three of you, for coming. Okay, with that, that is all the people who have signed up. So I'm going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 1587. We'll see what the amendments look like, and I will be scheduling a work session for next week. Colleagues, just to let you know, if you don't know, tomorrow is our deadline for posting our schedule for next week. If we are going to have the potential to work bills, we need to make that announcement tomorrow. So that may happen in the middle of our meeting tomorrow afternoon, but or maybe in the morning. So any questions about anything for the good of the order? Seeing none, we are adjourned. Seeing none, we are adjourned.